Hi, this is Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC On Demand. Podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads available when you want to listen at WNYC.org and iTunes.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed Hosting Services, providing application management, hosting, professional services, security services, and compliance solutions for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
It was suggested recently in The New Yorker that possessing an excessive carbon footprint is rapidly becoming the modern equivalent of wearing a scarlet letter. But if someone asked you what you're doing to decrease your carbon footprint, would you know what they meant exactly? Well, today on Please Explain, we're going to explore the meaning of the term carbon footprint. And joining us are Dr. Mark Jacobson, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University, and Dr. Catherine Norman, assistant professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Engineering at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Dr. Norman, what does the term carbon footprint come from?
Well, a carbon footprint is an effort to measure the scale of your activity in emitting greenhouse gases as you go about your daily life. The reason we call it a footprint is that it really came out of the literature and the policy of developing ecological footprints, which were traditionally reported in acres because they were really a spatial measure. The idea was to give people a simple and easy-to-understand indicator of ecological sustainability in the sense of understanding the burden that their lives placed on the productive capacity of the earth and the absorptive capacity of the environment for their wastes. By aggregating a lot of things into one number, you made it really transparent what the scale of your life or your society's life or what the earth's population was relative to what we had to work with. And it's kind of paralleled the move towards various green GDPs and environmental economics, which instead of assigning an acreage to every impact, would assign a dollar value to improvement of or degradation in the capacity of the earth to support the economy and the societies that are on it. And as climate concerns started to really dominate the dialogue on environmental impacts, the greenhouse gas effects of that footprint have been pulled out and done separately. You can also get water footprints and so on and so forth. So it's just a subset of this sense of understanding the scale of your activity relative to the scale of the planet.
Well, Dr. Jacobson, carbon is the building block of life. So when we're talking about a carbon footprint, should we really be saying carbon emission footprint, a carbon dioxide footprint?
Okay, so carbon footprint is really the total amount of all global warming pollutants converted to carbon dioxide, and these would be global warming pollutants that are emitted due to a given activity or a production of a given product. So those global warming pollutants that are important include carbon dioxide itself, methane, nitrous oxide. Ozone is a global warming pollutant, but it's not emitted. Chlorofluorocarbons, which are also problems with the ozone layer, but also soot, which is not a gas but a particle that comes out of the tailpipe of diesel exhaust, is actually the second most important component of global warming. And this is also accounted for in many analyses of carbon footprint.
Dr. Norman, people have been aware of a growing problem for a long time now. Why is it suddenly the big issue? Why are we suddenly talking about carbon footprints now?
Well, we're talking about carbon footprints now not because it's new science. The basic chemistry of the process has been understood for a very long time. You can go back to the end of the 19th century, and the first thing that you find in the record is a Swedish chemist named Arrhenius, whose name I might be mangling, and I apologize to the Swedes if so. Did some
rough. We'll take calls later, and we hope that somebody who knows Swedish will call in and correct you.
Fantastic. Yeah, then we'd all be learning. So at any rate, he did some rough calculations by hand, of course, back in the day, of the effects of increasing carbon emissions on the greenhouse effect, because he was trying to understand why the planet was warm enough to sustain life. And he made this little aside. He says, oh, you know, since this whole industrial revolution, we're burning a lot of fossil fuels, and that's going to accelerate. And he suspected that we might double the carbon in the atmosphere in 3,000 years and raise temperatures 5 or 6 degrees, which isn't that bad of an estimate for the 19th century. The current concern has arisen out of the increasing amounts of historic and current data that are available to natural scientists and the increasing availability of really powerful tools to analyze those, which gave us the famous hockey stick graph that showed that we'd gone off the traditional, but not the traditional, the historic trend of carbon concentrations in the atmosphere to something much, much steeper, that we were really accelerating this, and we wanted to know how sensitive the climate was to it. In my field, my training's in economics, we started thinking about the value of the environmental services provided by the climate seriously in the 70s, and the evidence has just become more and more overwhelming, and the magnitude of the risks involved has become more and more apparent, so there's been a lot more focus on it recently.
I just read that watching a plasma television for 3 hours every day contributes 250 kilograms of carbon to the atmosphere each year, and LCD television is responsible for less than half that number. But how do we even come up with those kinds of figures, Dr. Jacobson?
Well, they're through what are called life cycle analyses, where you look from the production of a given product, and then it's the electricity use, for example, during the use of that product. So, for example, in the case of a television, you have to account for all the materials that were used to produce the television, the energy that was used to produce the television and the materials, and also the transport of the television to a warehouse and to the eventual retail sales store, the transport of the television to your house. I mean, that's probably a smaller portion than the electricity that's used during the lifetime of the television, which could last 15 years or 20 years.
So in the case of the plasma versus the LED, that, or is it LED or LCD? I can't remember. We're really talking about the all of the things that went into creating the two kinds of television sets, but also the amount of electricity that they wound up using as a result of the different technologies?
Yes, correct. And in this case, most of the energy use is probably because of the one kind of the television versus another is because of the efficiency. I mean, one just uses more electricity than the other, and that's the same with many appliances. I mean, old refrigerators are a classic example. I mean, new refrigerators use like maybe three times less electricity than old refrigerators.
Well, and Dr. Norman, in the case of the food we eat, that also is not just a matter of what it takes to grow the food and what it takes to get to us, is it? For example, peanut butter. If we talk about peanut butter, we're talking about a wide range of things, including the carbon footprint that goes into the packaging, the making of the plastic jar that it's sent to us in.
Yes, that's correct. You're looking at the whole life cycle process, the production of the packaging, the production of the actual food. In the case of any kind of food product, you're looking at all the energy that went into the agricultural production, like the tractors, the fertilizers, the water use, and the energy that needed to bring the water there, all the farm workers, the energy that they use. It's a big process to try to understand any given product. It takes quite a lot of work and research to understand that.
My guests are Dr. Mark Jacobson, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford, and Dr. Catherine Norman, assistant professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Engineering at Johns Hopkins University. This is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC. AM and FM in New York. We're also available as a podcast. And let's get back to you, Dr. Norman. It seems to me that it must be rather difficult to calculate a carbon footprint in any kind of a truly accurate way because it's just so many different factors.
Well, it's really complicated. You have to decide where you're going to draw the boundaries of your analysis, and if you draw them in different places, you'll get a different answer. And it's not one of those things that's there's an obvious right answer as to where you ought to consider it. So there are innumerable calculators out there.
But people talk about a first order and a second order. What do they mean?
So a first order impact is when we're talking about your energy use, which is your TV. It's saying you're getting on this airplane and you're flying to Europe, and that's using X amount of jet fuel. The second order impacts are that you had to make that airplane, and a bunch of people had to drive to the airport, and you had to mine the minerals to make the airplane, and you had to build the machines to make the airplane. And so how many of these things you consider and how you account for things that are capital investments that have a long lifetime, how you account for their contribution to each individual activity is not a trivial problem. So there are government calculators, there are nonprofit calculators, there are calculators that are associated with specific businesses, either people who are in the business of selling offsets or people who are in the business of providing carbon-intensive services, and they want you to feel better about them, so they offer you the opportunity to mitigate. So you can look at the carbon footprint of your driving habits or your electricity use, but we have to know where your electricity came from. Is your electricity coming from pulverized coal? Is it coming from a nuclear plant? Is it coming from a windmill that had to be built? And so deciding where you're going to draw that boundary is really difficult. Most of the personal calculators that you see just make some very general assumptions about how your energy is made, and they focus on these first-order impacts so that we don't have to ask you in order to give you an estimate of your carbon burden on the ecology. We don't have to ask you how long you keep every single thing that's in your house and how it was made and where it traveled from and so on and so forth. And certainly the companies that are selling offsets have incentives to give you answers that make you more likely to buy offsets.
It sounds to me like the only way we can avoid all of this is to go live in a cave, although I probably would be adding to pollution by cooking my food from some sticks that I find.
Well, you could have raw food in a cave, a naturally occurring cave in a temperate climate.
You have pointed out that that when we cook potatoes, for example, even if they're nice organic potatoes, if we leave the lid off and boil them at a high temp, high heat, and then mash them, from a carbon standpoint, we might as well drive to McDonald's and spend our money buying an order of French fries. Is that true?
I actually have not pointed that
out. Oh, I thought I was told that it was you.
No, I've not made a potato calculation. It probably depends on if you use natural gas to cook your potato or you do it on your backyard grill, and how much use the fryolator at your McDonald's gets. Because if that's running continuously, then you can average out that impact over all the fries, and you're heating up this whole system for your one potato. You know, are you driving all the way to the McDonald's? How far is it? What are you driving? What kind of mileage do you get?
It does sound really complicated, and I'm feeling guilty. Dr. Jacobson, are we still the country responsible for doing the most damage to the Earth's atmosphere?
Yeah, well, let's separate this out into two types of damage. One is climate damage, and the other is air pollution damage. First, in terms of air pollution, actually, the United States is very clean. We have very stringent regulations, and although we still have very dirty air, and we still have 50 to 100,000 people die per year in the United States from air pollution, it is actually one of the cleaner, or closest to the cleanest country in the world in terms of urban air pollution. However, in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, equivalent greenhouse gas emissions, we're pretty much tied with China for the greatest emissions. We were ahead of China until just by this last year. But I should point out, even though we're tied with China as the greatest emitter of total emissions, China per person emits a lot less. They just have a much huger population. In fact, per person, the United States is about number five in the world in terms of emissions. The only countries that emit more per person than the United States in terms of greenhouse gases are Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and Singapore. And
but they all have small populations.
Yeah, they have very small populations, and their total aggregate country emissions are very small. So it's a little bit misleading, but just point out that but the United States, I mean, just to give a comparison, you know, maybe emits about twice as much per person almost as the United Kingdom's. And so it is, we are very strong emitters, but we do have potential to reduce these emissions in several ways, and maybe if we have time later, we'll talk about those.
Well, what about on a personal level? Is it simply a matter of making sure that we eat local foods and use the right kinds of light bulbs?
Yeah, well, at a personal level, people can do a lot, including, you know, improving their energy efficiency, shutting off lights, using compact fluorescent light bulbs, you know, driving less, and buying, you know, product. I don't know if it's so much buying local products, because, I mean, there's so much international trade right now. You know, any product you buy might have components from all over the world. So it's very difficult to tell what's local. I mean, all in all, I mean, everybody should try their best to reduce. It'll turn out that the best we can do if everybody makes an effort is maybe reduce 10 to 20% of the total emissions. However, we need about 80% emission reductions to actually address global warming. So it's going to be a combination of completely converting our infrastructure to a renewable energy infrastructure combined with personal habit changes that will solve this problem.
We're going to take a little break here, and when we come back, we'll take some calls. Our number is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. My guests are Dr. Mark Jacobson of Stanford University and Dr. Catherine Norman of Johns Hopkins University. 212-433-9692. And we're back with Please Explain, talking about carbon footprints with Dr. Catherine Norman, assistant professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Engineering at Johns Hopkins University, and Dr. Mark Jacobson, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University. Our number here, 212-433-9692. Before we get to the calls, just a couple more questions. Dr. Jacobson said that we need to cut back on our carbon footprint to 80%. Now, that means there's got to be a lot of changes implemented. Are people who are researching and creating the technology that allows us to use corn oil in our cars, for instance, are they doing the right thing, or are they going in the wrong direction, just creating a different kind of carbon footprint?
Yeah, they're going in the absolutely wrong direction in terms of addressing climate change. I mean, biofuels do not reduce the carbon footprint at all. In fact, the two most recent studies that came out just a few weeks ago and on this that accounted for land use change as part of the carbon footprint, they found that most biofuels, almost all biofuels, actually increase the carbon footprint significantly. For example, corn ethanol could nearly increase the amount of carbon emitted compared to gasoline by either 50% or more, and actually up to even 100%, primarily due to the fact that it's just the land use change. You're taking land that has high carbon storage, and you're converting it to agriculture often, which is the least carbon intensive use of land, or you're encouraging people in other parts of the world, because of rising prices due to corn, to grow corn and tear down forests there, which is storing a lot of carbon. So it's significantly bad in terms of the carbon footprint, either corn ethanol or cellulosic ethanol, which has been touted as the kind of ethanol of the future. This was also found to be bad. In terms of air pollution, these are also no better than gasoline. But the biggest problem with them is not so much that their carbon footprint is they distract from, they actually take funding away from the promotion of real renewables that can reduce carbon by up to 98%. I mean, we're talking about technologies in terms of biofuels that either increase or cause little change in the carbon, whereas if you spend money on that, you're not spending money on wind energy, solar energy, geothermal, hydroelectric, tidal, and wave power, which in combination can have significant benefits in terms of reducing carbon.
Well, I've seen huge arrays of windmills in Texas and California, but most of the power in those states is still provided by fossil fuels. So how many windmills must we build before we can start relying on wind power as a reasonable source of energy?
Well, here's a quick calculation. If we convert to electric vehicles, which are much more efficient than gasoline vehicles, I mean, the average electric vehicle has an efficiency of 75% to 85% compared to an internal combustion engine, which is like 17 to 19% efficient. You only need 100,000 5 megawatt, those are large wind turbines, in the United States in wind speeds about 8 to 8.5 meters per second. To power the entire U.S. vehicle fleet. Now, 100,000 5-megawatt windmills may sound like a lot, but you know, the United States during World War II produced 300,000 airplanes. So it's entirely feasible, and it really just takes a willpower to kind of go forward and a policy that goes forward to promote the use of real renewables and not these kind of phony renewables like biofuels.
It'll also take a lot of land to put up all of those windmills.
Actually, not really. It takes, to power the entire U.S. vehicle fleet with these 100,000 5-megawatt wind turbines, it takes 30 times less land than to power the entire fleet with corn ethanol, and 20 times less land than to power it with cellulosic ethanol. So it's actually not very land intensive in terms of just the spacing. And plus, you can use almost all the land underneath the wind turbines for grazing or for agriculture or for other purposes. You're only the actual footprint on the ground, and I don't mean to confuse footprints, of a wind turbine, of all these wind turbines to power the entire vehicle fleet, it would take up 1 square kilometer of land in the United States, just because all you're putting is that doesn't count for the roads you would need to get there, but just the actual footprint of the turbines is very small.
Let's go to some of our callers. Our number here, 212-433-9692. Catherine from Red Bank, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Actually, it's Kathleen.
Kathleen, hi.
I'm fine. I have a couple of questions. One is, how can the individual determine their own carbon footprint?
Dr. Norman?
Well, there are numerous calculators that you can look at online that will calculate it for you. I believe there's one up currently at NPR, actually, which is based on the Redefining Progress calculator, which is very respected. I know I've said that there isn't yet a standard, and I think that we will have one soon, but all of them are going to give you roughly similar numbers. And so you can go to the Redefining Progress one is also mirrored at earthday.org, I believe. And you can go in and it will ask you questions about where you live and what kind of a house you live in and how much you drive and how much you travel and how much waste you produce. And it'll give you a rough estimate of how many tons of carbon your lifestyle is generating.
Okay.
And my follow-up question is there also a reference for ways that the average American can reduce their carbon footprint?
Absolutely. Every one of these sites is linked straight to a what can I do to reduce measure. And there are a lot of things we can do, and it's easy to get a little bit discouraged when you say, well, gosh, I don't know whether to go get the fries at McDonald's or to boil a potato at home. But there are innumerable things that we can do that are fairly simple, many of which are extremely cost-effective, that make real differences.
Such as?
The light bulbs, walking to work if it's possible, living in a place that enables you to not have to drive that much, being able to shop locally, trying not to buy things that you don't need, since almost everything that you buy and was fairly energy intensive in its production.
Every time,
better insulation, buying Energy Star appliances, which the Energy Star program has a basic rule that says that it has to pay back in terms of energy savings for you cost-wise within 4 or 5 years for most products. So that's easy, and you'll win.
Every time someone says we should switch to those new fluorescent light bulbs, I get a call, at least one call, from a listener who says, well, what about the mercury in those bulbs?
Well, there is mercury in those bulbs, but the fact of the matter is that if you have an incandescent bulb in your house, the additional energy that is being used by that bulb is almost certainly being at least partly generated by a coal-fired power plant, and coal-fired power plants are responsible for much, much more mercury emissions over the life of that incandescent bulb than are in the compact fluorescent bulb. So it is important, if you use compact fluorescents, to make sure that you dispose of them in a responsible way. But that mercury is contained. The mercury that comes out of the smokestack is less contained, and it's harder to deal with, and it spreads itself around the entire environment.
And there are places that will take those fluorescent light bulbs and recycle them.
I do not know if they recycle them or if they dispose of them in some sort of stable, non-mercury-releasing way, but certainly your city's toxics program will probably take them. In my town, IKEA takes them back because they sell a lot of compact fluorescent light bulbs.
Let's go to Mike from Pauling, New York. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I heat with firewood, and
with firewood as well?
Pardon?
Do you cook with firewood as well, or just you have
used
a fireplace?
In my first house, I had a warm morning Monarch kitchen range, but no, we have a stove in our living room, and we heat with firewood from the property, I cut down the dead standing and the trees that have dropped or are going to rot. And my question is, people tell me that I add to global warming or I add to the carbon, and I say, well, no, I'm not pulling that out of the ground. And then I had one other question about the new air car that some French inventor has developed about the carbon footprint and the likelihood, the usefulness of that new car.
Okay, so how bad are carbon emissions from burning wood?
Yeah, am I adding to the global warming because it's going to rot and give off carbon dioxide anyway?
Go ahead, Dr. Jacobson.
I'll try to handle this. Well, there are two issues, actually. The one is probably even more serious, is the air pollution emissions from firewood.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the thing I'd be concerned about the most, because it's particles from burning of anything that are the most dangerous components of human health.
Soot.
Soot is one of the types of particles, and there are other types of particles, but they're very dangerous. And in fact, many communities are trying to ban the use of firewood. And now, if you're in a remote area, I don't know where you live, but if you're in a remote area, it may not affect too many people. But if a lot of people do the same thing, then it is a significant problem. Mm-hmm. In terms of the carbon emissions, well, if it's hard to say. I mean, burning wood is not very efficient. It's not a very efficient mechanism of producing heat. But on the other hand, if it's dead wood, that would rot anyway. It depends if the wood that you're gathering would have converted to carbon dioxide anyway. A lot of the wood, if you bury it, for example, you'll store it for a long time as well. Or maybe it would just sit around for 20 years and be storing the carbon. So if it's something that would decay within a year, then if you burned it in terms of the carbon, you're not really adding much carbon. But if it's something that would just stay as a solid piece of wood for 20 years, by burning it, you're actually putting that carbon from that stored, sequestered wood. You're taking wood that was sequestering carbon for a while and putting it in the atmosphere. So because of the efficiency loss of the wood, you're maybe not doing too much better than...
Okay.
And you also want to know about that air car in France?
The French air car, the MDI, have you heard of it?
You know anything about that, Dr. Norman?
No, I'm afraid I haven't heard about the French air car.
Well, we don't know about the air car, but the French and some other Europeans have also been switching over to high-speed trains. Do they cut down on the carbon footprint?
High-speed trains. How many people are riding them. If they're packed, which I assume they are, certainly compared to people driving cars, trains are beneficial. I don't know if you want to compare it to other types of trains. I can't really say. I don't know how efficient the high-speed train is versus kind of non-high-speed trains. But any type of mass transit is definitely beneficial. Although, people have done calculations of flying in an airplane. How much carbon do you emit flying an airplane relative to driving a car per mile? And it turns out, if the plane is full, it's about the same per mile. However, it doesn't mean you should justify yourself taking lots of plane trips, because you usually, fly 3,000 miles on a plane where you're only going, 100 miles in a car. So there are a lot of issues to consider. But I think mass transit in general, it reduces carbon.
We go now to Joe from New Jersey. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
How are you doing?
We're okay.
Good.
What's your question?
Well, I have more of a comment. In New Jersey, we have a choice of purchasing our electricity through the Bureau of Public Utilities Clean Power Choice Program. The average household in New Jersey uses 775 kilowatt hours of electricity per month, and my supplier generates that through coal, a little bit of nuclear, about 37% nuclear, and the rest is natural gas. When you purchase your electricity from the power company, you're putting 12,000 pounds of carbon dioxide in the air each year. If you buy your electricity from the Clean Power Choice Program, They generate it with wind turbines, solar arrays, small hydroelectric plants, and there's no pollution. It costs about 1.3 cents per kilowatt hour to get in the plant, which is about $7 or $8 a month, but you can negate most of that cost by buying compact fluorescents.
So why doesn't anyone just why doesn't everyone just switch over to that?
Boy, I don't know. But it's
Catherine?
I think one of the reasons that people have not taken those up as much as you might otherwise expect is that people are wary of the accounting behind those. There's some concern that, you know, someone's generating a permit being sold to 10 people who are all, quote-unquote, greenwashing their operations, which is why I would argue strongly for a standardized policy for calculating carbon impacts of things. It's akin to the organic food question. So for 15 years ago, you were concerned about pesticides in food. You could go and buy organic food, and there were 10 or 20 different certification agencies, and you didn't know which one to pick, and you had to go and research what the Soil Association meant when they said organic versus what I meant when I said Catherine's fancy organic, and decide which one was most consistent with your principles. And so no one did it because it was just too uncertain, and it was too unclear, and it wasn't transparent. And the USDA picked a standard, and they said, this is what we're going to call organic. And it wasn't the strictest one, and it wasn't the loosest one. And as soon as people said, well, this is a certified thing, I know who these people are, this is the USDA, organic sales shot through the roof. And I think it's a credibility question for a lot of folks when they're deciding whether or not to participate in these green schemes. They want to know that they're really making a difference. And sometimes it can be hard to do that when there isn't a broader regulatory framework.
What are cap-and-trade regulations, Catherine?
So cap-and-trade regulations just mean that you set a standard. You say, this is the amount that we are okay with emitting on the whole as a policy. And the idea is that you will allocate these permits. You'll create a property right for each unit of that pollutant that you're going to emit, so sulfur dioxide in the past, potentially carbon in the future, and you'll buy a carbon permit to account for every ton of carbon equivalent gases that you emit, either as an industry or on your consumption choices, depending on how it's administered. And so you can either use your permit to offset your use, or you can sell it to someone else. And so the theory is that the people for whom it is cheapest to reduce their emissions will reduce their emissions and sell their permits because the money that they get from the permits will be more than it would cost them to reduce. And so you'll get the low-hanging fruit first. You'll get the easy things. And this is significant. People who have researched the efficiency opportunities and the quote-unquote no-regrets measures for addressing climate change show that there are huge chunks of emissions reductions that can be gotten at little to no cost. So the theory of a cap-and-trade system is that you make sure you get those first instead of just saying everyone has to cut your carbon emissions by 20% tomorrow without recognizing that for some people that 20% is easier than for other people.
Now, let me get Mark Jacobson in here. So who really is going to have to bear the greatest brunt here? These companies, and some are going green, the individuals, or is government really the key to turning this whole problem around, if we can?
It's really government has to solve this problem or help to solve the problem, but it's really people pushing the government in the right direction. Because, as I mentioned, I mean, individuals, we can only work with what we have. I mean, if we're only given, you know, fossil fuel vehicles to run, then people don't have a choice. If we're only given a choice of power plants that produce or, you know, use coal or natural gas, then, you know, all we can do is try to reduce our energy use, but people need to use some energy.
Well, Al Gore really made this an important part of his campaign, and, well, he may have won the election, but he lost the election. And there's been a lot of resistance from the Bush administration, but there was also resistance from Congress during the Clinton years. So do you think it's even possible?
It is possible, but it's really information. I mean, most people don't have information. If you look at the candidates right now, I mean, most of them push biofuels, for example, although, I mean, the state of the knowledge is that these don't do anything. And so, you know, the government leaders have to be informed about what's good and what's bad. But there are possible things, I mean, to do. I mean, we can convert to renewable energy if we, you know, have a large-scale program, like an Apollo-like program to do this. And we can, combine, these different renewables, including hydroelectric power and geothermal power and tidal and wave power and wind and solar power together. But individuals can also do things on their own. I mean, buying solar panels is very useful. I did that in my house in California, and I don't pay any more electricity bill. Now, it's very expensive up front. Solar is very expensive. It's much more expensive than wind energy on the large scale, even for individuals. However, when you buy solar panels, it'll pay itself off over 15 to 30 years. I mean, right now, it would be 15 years with good tax credits, but without such good tax credits, it might take up to 30 years.
It does
pay itself off.
We have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Dr. Mark Jacobson, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Stanford, and Dr. Catherine Norman, Assistant Professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Engineering at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you so much for participating in today's Please Explain.
Thank you,
Leonard. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out the other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This is a free service made available by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.